Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's been a tough year for the country's mayors with the intersecting pressures of a pandemic, economic losses, and racial upheaval. Here in Massachusetts, we will see a lot of mayoral races as mayors like Somerville's Joe Curtatone, Holyoke's Alex Morse choose not to run again. But a different mayoral story is playing out at the Moakley Courthouse this week as the corruption trial of former Fall River mayor and political phenom Jaisal Correa goes to the jury. Correa faces 24 counts ranging from extortion to wire fraud as he stands accused of stealing from investors who backed his smartphone app when he was an entrepreneur and extorting hundreds of thousands of dollars from marijuana businesses looking to operate in the city when he was mayor. Ben Burke, the South Coast Bureau reporter for the Publix Radio, has been covering the trial since it began and joins us now. Ben, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana.
So, Ben, I gave a quick glimpse there of the charges against Correa. Finish the picture for us. Why is he on trial?
So those 24 criminal charges fall into two pretty distinct arenas. The first is a startup Correa founded fresh out of college called Snow Owl. He's accused of siphoning money investors put into the business to buy things like a Mercedes and expensive trips to hotels, casinos, and expensive dinners at high-end restaurants. An IRS investigator said he spent almost two-thirds of the company's money on himself. And he was a charismatic businessman who brought in almost $400,000 in investments. The second arena that these charges revolve around is actually Fall River city government. So Correa was elected when he was just 23 years old. And he's accused after taking office of quite a lot of things. First off, he's accused of stealing nearly half of his chief of staff's salary. He's also accused of taking a Rolex from a landlord who wanted the city to pay for his water hookup. But by far the most lucrative corruption Correa is accused of is a pay-to-play scheme he allegedly set up to control the city's marijuana licensing. Weed had just been legalized, and several people trying to open dispensaries in Fall River claim Correa demanded secret cash payments to get his seal of approval.
So when were the first rumblings of concern, Ben? When did we first start hearing accusations? Was it before he was mayor, or did all of this come out once he was in office?
The mayor that Correa ran against when he was just 23 was a former district attorney named Sam Sutter. And on the campaign trail, Sutter was asking some pretty pointed questions about Snow Owl. I don't think anybody knew the feds were actually investigating Snow Owl until about 2 years into Correa's term, though.
So what's the defense's response to this? What case did they lay out during the trial?
So for the charges related to Correa's company, his attorney, Kevin Reddington, has argued that Correa simply didn't know that he couldn't use the money for himself. It was his company, so he felt the money was his to spend. That's not really how the laws governing corporations work, but the strategy that Reddington is taking there is intent. The judge told the jury that in order to convict Correa of fraud, they need to find there's proof Correa deliberately misled his investors. As for the alleged corruption at City Hall, Reddington is focused on discrediting the witnesses who say they passed bribes on to Correa. Reddington is trying to say basically that these middlemen were out scamming for themselves, and once they got caught, they were willing to, quote, dance the dance for prosecutors in exchange for lighter jail sentences.
So Correa has been really politically resilient, Ben. I remember we covered it here on WBUR when, remarkably, he was both recalled and reelected to office in a single night 2 years ago. So where's public sentiment toward him in Fall River now?
That recall was an incredible night, but it might have more to do with how the election was structured rather than a sign of enduring loyalty in Fall River. most voters in that election wanted Correa out of office, but there were five candidates running to replace Correa, including himself. So he won only about 35% of the vote back then, but that was enough to take it. And in the subsequent mayoral race, I think he only pulled in about 1 in 5 voters.
And that was just a few months later, correct?
Yes.
So what are we hearing from people in Fall River now that, you know, the prosecution and the defense have both made their cases and it goes to the jury?
Yeah, I think people are concerned that this case is going to cast a negative shadow on Fall River. There are a lot of people there working hard to help that city's economy recover, to bring that city into another era. And I think they're hoping that, you know, people see this as something from the past, that the city's moved past.
So is there a sort of sensational tinge to all of this, Ben, or has it unfolded as a pretty matter-of-fact trial?
Trials are quite slow. So as somebody who's been sitting there on a wooden seat in the courtroom, I would say it feels remarkably tame. A lot of these accusations we've heard for several months.
Any highlights?
Yeah, absolutely. Jaisal Correa's ex-girlfriend actually took the stand during the trial to testify about various gifts that he bought her with money from Snow Owl. Some of those disclosures were pretty personal.
So now, how long could the jury be deliberating? There are 24 counts, and I understand they have to consider them one at a time.
The short answer is we simply don't know. You know, it could take several days, but the jury room is a black box that we cannot see into. All the reporters that are covering the trial are glued to this Zoom feed waiting to see when they come out.
Does that include you? Do you have it in the background while we're talking?
Yeah. But tomorrow I've got the golden ticket and I'm allowed to go into the courtroom myself. One reporter is allowed in per day because of COVID restrictions.
Okay. And Ben, last question. If he's convicted, what kind of sentence could he face? And when would that happen?
Typically, sentencing occurs about 3 months after the conviction in federal court. Since we don't know which of these charges are going to stick, it's impossible to say what the sentence is going to be. But I did ask a law professor who's been following the trial, Michael Yelnoski, to share what he thinks. And you know, he said if Correa is convicted on all 24 charges, he could be facing 5 to 10 years in prison.
All right. That was South Coast Bureau reporter for the Publix Radio, Ben Burke. Ben, thanks so much.
Thank you.
News today that the FDA has cleared the two-dose Pfizer-BioNTech coronavirus vaccine for use in children ages 12 to 15. Now, this comes as cases continue to drop here in the Commonwealth. More restrictions are eased, and close to 3 million Bay State residents are now fully vaccinated. Governor Baker met just this afternoon virtually with President Biden to talk about vaccine distribution. Still, with all that said, indoor mask mandates persist, so do gathering size restrictions. And that makes us ask what we ask you every Tuesday. What questions do you have about the coronavirus, about vaccines, variants, vaccinating younger residents, and some kind of return to normal? It's time to ask the doctors. Call with your questions at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now to help answer those questions, we have Dr. Christopher Gill, an infectious disease clinician and researcher who focuses on vaccines and the epidemiology of respiratory diseases at Boston University, and also Dr. Helen Boucher, chief of infectious diseases at Tufts Medical Center and a professor at the Tufts University School of Medicine. Dr. Boucher, welcome back.
Thanks so much, Tiziana.
And Dr. Gill, welcome back to you too.
Such a pleasure to be here.
So, Dr. Boucher, I'll start with you. What's your reaction to the expansion of this emergency authorization on Pfizer for 12 years old and up?
Well, this is really good news, Tiziana, and it means that we're one step closer to stopping the spread of this virus. We know that adolescents and teenagers are very social beings and can spread the virus, and they're also at risk to become ill with COVID. So for lots of reasons, we're very excited that vaccination is now an option for this age group.
And Dr. Gill, tell us about this authorization. How did the FDA look at and see the efficacy? How did it test safety? This is a younger population.
Sure. So I think a lot of us were somewhat, not skeptical is the wrong word, but uncertain how this trial would be able to demonstrate clinical efficacy, because the rates of symptomatic COVID infection in adolescents is relatively lower than in older individuals, but not as low as in very young children, of course. And so the study was designed, and this is actually part of this larger sort of omnibus phase one, two, and three clinical trial that Pfizer has been running, and was one of the sort of the later endpoints. Just to note, there's about over 60 endpoints in this trial. So this is a huge and very complicated study. And in this case, we were uncertain whether they would be able to enroll enough children who would have symptomatic disease to demonstrate clinical efficacy, but they did. And actually there were no symptomatic cases at all in the group of approximately a thousand adolescents who had received the two doses of the Pfizer vaccine. Whereas there was, quite a number of cases in the placebo arm who received the saline control. And so in this case, the measured efficacy of the vaccine was about 100%. But there were also some interesting sort of immunologic aspects to this, which I think the Pfizer had been, had included in the trial because they thought this would be important if it were the case that they couldn't demonstrate an impact on symptomatic disease, because symptomatic disease would be so rare, where they looked at the immunological response in terms of the vaccine to induce these so-called neutralizing antibodies. And they did a comparison of the two groups of teenagers within this study, the very younger ones who were between 12 and 14 years old, and then the slightly older ones who were up to 16 years old, and that they found that the ability of the vaccine, the two doses of the vaccine to lead to this sort of immunologic protection was equivalent in both groups. So again, super, super reassuring, and the side effect profile was very similar to what was reported in adults.
All right. So to that point, we've got our first call at 800-423-8255 about vaccinating younger adolescents. We've got Jeff on the line in Andover. Jeff, go ahead with your question.
Hi there. Yeah, I've got a 13 and 14 year old, and the efficacy is not so much of an issue, but it seems like a very, very small group of kids were tested with this. And that concerns me as far as the safety issues around getting them vaccinated. My wife and I are all vaccinated, and we're comfortable, and we believe in all the work that's being done around safety. But as it applies to the kids, is there anything you can say to reassure me about feeling good about doing this for the kids when we have such a small group that was tested?
Dr. Boucher. Or Dr. Gill, if either of you, let's talk to Jeff here. Go ahead.
Helen, why don't you go first?
Yeah, I'll start. You know, it's important to remember that this is a very small age group, right? Just 3 years. And 1,000 people in this age group is actually a substantial number. As Dr. Gill pointed out, it's enough to know that we can see efficacy. And there's no reason, based on all the data we have about the mRNA technology, and it's important to remember, it's been being studied for over a decade. There's no reason to believe that there would be anything different about how young people would respond. And we have quite a body of evidence in age 16, 17 year olds that have been vaccinated already. And we haven't seen anything different than the sore arm, muscle aches, maybe a low fever for a couple of days following vaccination. And what we do have evidence of is that COVID can be bad, and that the post-COVID inflammatory syndrome in children can be very bad. So, you know, in my mind, the risk benefit is very clearly in favor of the vaccine in this age group.
And Dr. Gill, if I'm correct, it's the same dosage as it is for children ages 16 and 17. Am I right about that?
That is correct, which is generally true of vaccines. It is the exception rather than the rule that we dose vaccines, at least the number of micrograms or nanograms, depending on the vaccine. It's very rare that we would dose them at different sizes based on age. Very often we would give different numbers of doses, but the actual size of the of each dose is almost always the same vaccines.
And before we go back to the calls, which are blowing up, just one more question on this, because this is the news of the day. What should we then anticipate, that we're going to see similar studying, or maybe it's already going on with children under the age of 12? And is there something on the horizon there, Dr. Boucher?
There is. And so the study is continuing into lower age groups. And I'll point out that the Moderna vaccine is being studied in a similar fashion into younger age children. And there's going to be a meeting in the next few weeks of the FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee to discuss the particular criteria that will be used to determine the efficacy and safety of the vaccine in these younger age children. So that's open to the public, and you know, we're all going to stay tuned for that discussion.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Thanks to both of you for those answers. 1-800-423-8255 to ask your coronavirus and vaccine questions. We've got Ray on the line from Norfolk. Ray, go ahead.
Hi, I recently went to a dental appointment where I figured out halfway through the hygienist didn't have her vaccine. And as a former cancer patient, I wondered, what is the responsibility of the provider to have a vaccine or to disclose that they haven't? Thank you.
Thanks, Ray. Dr. Gill.
It's a really complicated ethical question you're asking, Ray, because on the one hand, you could say that healthcare providers have a right to not be vaccinated as other individuals have a right, and yet they have a particular responsibility to be vaccinated because they're exposing potentially others who are at high risk because of the nature of their work. And so I think the balance of risk and benefit is so far leaning towards the need for such individuals to be vaccinated. And so you're in a situation where you were concerned because the dental hygienist had not been vaccinated, but actually a close friend of our family had a really tragic example of what you're describing quite recently. It was an elderly set of parents, aged 99 and 100 each, who had made it all the way through the COVID pandemic and were about to be vaccinated when they were exposed both to COVID by their home health aide. And they both acquired COVID and both died within a week.
Oh dear.
So this is exactly what we're talking about, that individuals who are around patients, and particularly individuals who are vulnerable, which is many patients, I think there's a strong ethical obligation to get vaccinated.
And Dr. Boucher, is it appropriate to ask in a healthcare environment whether the people who are, and this is a genuine question for me, whether people who are treating you have been vaccinated, or are there privacy concerns around that?
Well, as Dr. Gill mentioned, you know, the ethics around this are complicated. I can share with you that we are being asked. We're being asked as healthcare workers, and we're being asked socially. I got an invitation recently that on the RSVP requested your vaccination status. And I think to Dr. Gill's point, the obligation that we have as healthcare workers is somewhat different. And we make an oath to put our patients first. And we, for a long time, have been mandating influenza vaccines to keep our patients safe. And many could argue that the risk that influenza poses is not as great as the risk that COVID poses. So I think you're going to see a lot of this dialogue happening. And again, I'll come back to where I started. I am well aware of a number of people asking their doctor, their nurse, their dentist about their vaccine status already.
Let's go back to the phones. Many calls. We've got the number is 800-423-8255. We've got Edith on the line in Beverly. Edith, what's your question?
Hi. I had COVID and was asymptomatic last March 2020, and I still don't have my smell back. Can you tell me about that?
Dr. Gill.
No. I wish I could. I think the truth is we still don't very well understand what it is that causes this loss of taste and smell. And my suspicion is that the loss of taste is largely actually due to the loss of smell. I think we have some clues as to what might be happening here, which is the fact that the olfactory nerve, which is the nerve that you know, travels down the base of our brain and sort of enters the airways high up into our sinuses, is the only nerve that's really open to the outside world. And so it seems that somehow COVID, which, you know, often starts as an upper respiratory tract infection, not always, but often, is causing some sort of pathology that affects the olfactory nerve. But exactly what that pathology is, it's very unclear. And how long it will last and how long it will take before the sense of smell returns, I think we just don't know yet.
Edith, I want to note my chuckling was at Dr. Gill's friendly sheepishness, not at your situation, but I will come back to you and ask you.
Great question. I just wish I knew better.
Yeah. And have you lost your sense of taste along with your sense of smell, Edith?
No, I never lost my taste, but my smell started to come back in September and I could smell coffee, but I still can't smell anything I cook. So I burn things and I can barely smell flowers.
Oh, so unfair, especially now.
Well, keep listening, Edith, because as research does come out, if it ever does on that, I'm sure we'll have it here on Ask the Doctors. But our thoughts are with you. I am glad for you, though, that you can at least smell coffee. I know that that's one of my favorite smells in the morning. Let's go back here to the phones, and we've got Eric on the line in Dorchester. Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, how you doing? I have a question. I'm wondering if there is any data that shows people who have received the full either two or one dose vaccine have transmitted the virus to people.
Okay. Dr. Gill, go ahead.
Yes, albeit rarely. But I want to focus on the question you're asking, because there's been a lot of discussion in the scientific communities as well as in the lay communities about the degree to which these vaccines impede person-to-person spread. And so I kind of want to roll it back and give a little bit more of a comprehensive answer about this, starting with the basic science, which is, as we understand it, the COVID virus is able to invade a cell, a respiratory epithelial cell, by binding its spike protein to something called the ACE2 receptor. And the COVID vaccines, which target the key portion of the spike protein that is the key that fits into that lock, is how these vaccines are all designed and the mechanism by which they work. That if you inhibit that binding of the virus to its target cell, the virus can't get in. If it can't get in, it can't replicate. And so in theory, you look at that and you say, well, you know, if it can't replicate, how could it cause person-to-person spread? And actually, that's a very logical starting point, is that we assume that it would. But of course, we want more evidence. And the evidence has been forthcoming because we've seen in non-primate models that when you vaccinate mice or ferrets or rabbits or some test animal or even a primate model, that and then you look to see does the vaccination reduce the shedding of the virus in the nasopharynx of those test animals? The answer is clearly yes. We have found that when you give a monoclonal antibody, which is designed to do exactly the same thing as a vaccine-induced antibody, you also get a decrease in viral load, which we know from other situations is the mechanism by which you reduce transmission and reducing the contagiousness. And then we have evidence from Moderna showing that there was 80% reduction in person-to-person spread just after the first dose of their vaccine, which has since been reported also by Pfizer and AstraZeneca. And now we have evidence from the real world, from Scotland and from Israel, showing that these vaccines significantly reduce person-to-person spread. But they do not reduce it to zero. They reduce it by about 80 or 90%. And so there is still some small potential to transmit, albeit a lower rate, but the rate is not zero.
All right. Thank you for that. And before we go back to the phones, Dr. Boucher, I'm going to ask you a follow-on to that we are hearing regularly from listeners. And this is from listeners who have had COVID-19 and they wonder whether they should or still need to get a vaccine. And I've even heard a variation on that, which gives you better or more effective immunity to contracting the coronavirus again yourself, the vaccine or having had the virus before. So can you just clear that one up for us a little bit?
Absolutely. So our recommendation is that if you have had COVID disease, that you do get fully vaccinated. And that is because we still don't know how long the natural protection from infection lasts. And we also don't know if the natural protection is as robust as the protection you get from vaccine. We know from very good studies and thousands of people now that vaccine protection is robust and that it lasts for a very long time. We still don't know how long, right? We know it's at least 6 months, but we're learning as we go. It may well be on order of years. So we don't want anyone to be left behind and underprotected. So we recommend that you go ahead, once you're out of isolation after being infected, that you go ahead and get vaccinated.
And Dr. Boucher, are we studying people who have had the coronavirus to see how long that natural immunity lasts? Are you aware of research in that area?
We are. In fact, we're very focused on what we call reinfection. So people who might be having a second infection after a natural infection, and whether or not that's related whether they've been subsequently vaccinated or not. There are a number of so-called natural history studies going on to see what happens about reinfection, and we're learning, obviously, as we go. But as of yet, I'm not aware of any data that clearly answers that question.
Let's go back to the phones, and you can call in with your coronavirus and vaccine question for Drs. Boucher and Gill at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Heather on the line in Cambridge in a vehicle. Heather, what's your question?
Hi, yes, I have an 11-year-old, and I'm curious, like, why the cutoff? Like, what's the difference between age 11 and age 12? And when, I know they're working on vaccines for a younger age group, but is there any idea when that might be available? I'm hoping before school starts in the fall.
Dr. Gill.
Yeah, so Heather, your confusion is totally understandable, because the answer is not a very good answer, which is that it's pretty much arbitrary. It was decided to study, 12 through 15 years old. They could have studied 11 through 15 year olds. They could have done 10. The decision was to do 12. It was an arbitrary line in the sand. And it kind of harks back to one of the earlier questions in the segment, which was, how confident can we be that the vaccine will perform well in younger and younger age groups? And so if you sort of think, well, it worked, very well, 16 and above, it worked apparently equally well in 12 to 15 or above, there's really no reason to be suspicious that it wouldn't work for some strange reason in an 11-year-old and a 10-year-old. Now, as we get younger and younger and younger, that answer does change, because once we get into the young toddlers, and particularly infants, their immune systems are really quite different. And so there, the question is how many doses they will need to achieve effective immunity. And obviously, if it's like going to be a 3 or 4 dose series, as with many of the infant vaccines, then we're looking at a rather longer study to try to answer that question. So I think we're probably a ways off on that. But I would be surprised, frankly, if we didn't have an answer to your question about your 11-year-old probably by the end of the summer.
So let's go back to the phones, 800-423-8255. Joanne's on the line in Brighton. Hi, Joanne, what's your question?
Hi, yes, I'm calling because I'm not a conspiracy theorist. My husband and I have both been vaccinated. But when you take prepubescent girls, you do worry. And all of the cloud that surrounded people who were concerned about fertility. And I just want to have all my fears put to rest that there really is no risk and there's no link and no scientific evidence of any fertility issues with the vaccine and young girls when you weigh the risk.
Thanks, Joanne. Let's turn to Dr. Boucher. Dr. Boucher, what do you have for Joanne?
Yeah, well, so this is one where I actually can give you some really good evidence, Joanne. So the unfortunate information that was circulated about fertility has actually been proven to be false. So there was some internet publications that suggested that this protein called syncytin was present, and it's a placental protein. And it turns out that protein is not involved with either COVID vaccine, any COVID vaccines, or COVID itself. This has been scientifically completely debunked. It was published in the British Medical Journal, among other places, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, a number of other very important organizations have published on this, so that you can be very much assured that there is no signal in the test tube, in animals, or in people of an effect on COVID vaccines and fertility.
Joanne, are you still there?
Oh, yes,
I think we
I'm
may
here.
Have a lot. There you are. So, Joanne, does that make you feel better? Does that help answer your question?
That does make me feel better. You just think about how the risk is truly not that high to kids when they get very sick. It seems less. So you don't want to be foolish, but I want to get my kids vaccinated. So thank you.
Thanks for the call, Joanne. And before we go to the next caller, Dr. Gill, to Joanne's point there, one of the questions that has come up a lot recently is whether the new variants are proving more risky or more infectious to children and young people than sort of the original strain of the virus. Are we seeing increased concern about infections for kids and risk for kids?
I'm not aware that there has been a particular increased risk for kids. I don't know, Helen, have you heard anything about that?
Well, there have been some data that have shown that in the recent phases of the epidemic where we're seeing predominantly B.1.1.7, one of the variants of concern. The age of infected individuals is younger, and there have been an increasing number of young people, including adolescents, who've been sick enough to be hospitalized. So I've seen that as reports from places like Michigan, where they've been particularly hard hit. I haven't seen anything more broad than at a state level.
Let's go back to the phones here. 1-800-423-8255. We have Paul on the line from Litchfield, New Hampshire. Go ahead, Paul.
Hi. I'm a 72-year-old man in good condition, but I have suffered in the past very, very serious anaphylactic shock. I almost died with a penicillin shot, and I've gotten different opinions about whether or not I should take the shot, and if I should take the shot, should I take one of the mRNA shots, or should I stick with the Johnson & Johnson? I just wondered what your opinion is.
Dr. Gill.
Super complicated answer. I am not aware that there's any cross risk from a penicillin allergy towards COVID vaccines or really any vaccines. The vaccine that is often maybe sort of implicated most in terms of causing allergic reactions is the seasonal flu reaction. And that's amongst people who are allergic to egg antigens, because the vaccines are actually incubated and developed inside chicken eggs. And so there's some residual chicken egg antigen that is taken up into the vaccine, and that's where those allergies come from. But I don't think that applies in the current situation, because the antigen and the delivery mechanism is completely distinct. So I would think that would be an exceptionally low risk.
Thanks for that. All right, so we've still got lots of calls coming in. Let's just keep at them. 800-423-8255 for Jeff, who's in Cape Cod, also in a vehicle. Jeff, go right ahead.
Hi. I had the Johnson & Johnson vaccine back in March. And at the time, I was being treated for gout with prednisone. And when I told my family doctor that I had gotten a shot, his reaction was kind of, it might have been better if you had waited, thinking that the prednisone might have some sort of effect on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So I've been kind of looking around trying to find some information, really can't find anything. So I thought I would ask you guys today what you thought.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Boucher?
Yeah, so fortunately, we know that there were patients included in the trials of all the vaccines who were on drugs like prednisone. And so that efficacy was seen across that 80 to 95% efficacy that we saw was seen, including patients who were on drugs like prednisone. So I think that you're good to go with your vaccine. And, you know, I think these considerations really, unless you're on very, very high doses, higher than we would typically use for a gout flare, we wouldn't recommend deferring or waiting to be vaccinated because of the benefit and the benefit to you from the vaccine and the risk of potentially getting COVID.
Let's go back to the phones. We'll pick up a call here, 800-423-8255. Marcia has a question in Wellesley. Marcia, it's your turn.
Yes, I was wondering how long one should wait after having been diagnosed with COVID. I'm referring to two specific cases, one of a 33-year-old man and one of a 35-year-old woman who was pregnant when she was diagnosed, had a very mild case of COVID, has now delivered her baby. So I'm wondering how long they have to, each of them, has to wait before they should get the COVID vaccine.
And this is after diagnosis. Thanks, Dr. Gill.
Yeah, no, there's no reason to wait. Go ahead and get vaccinated immediately.
That is so straightforward. I love it when the answers are that straightforward. Okay, let's pick up another call here from Erica. I can't see on my screen, sorry, where Erica is calling in from. Erica, maybe you can tell us and go ahead and ask your question.
Sure. Hi, I'm calling in from Foxborough, Mass. And just had a question. I just got my second dose, all but 10 minutes ago, and was curious. I had a pretty strong reaction. I had a pretty strong reaction to the first dose of Pfizer. So I was just curious, two-part question. One, does that mean, because my reaction was strong to the first dose, that I potentially was carrying around COVID and not knowing, so asymptomatic carrier at one point? And then second, am I going to go down hard again on the second dose?
Oh, Eric, I'm sorry you went down hard on the first dose, but I am happy for you that you've had both doses. Dr. Boucher, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I think the good news is, Erica, you have a healthy immune system, and we know that a good immune response is what causes these types of adverse events and the side effects that you're feeling. We've heard anecdotal reports that people who've had COVID before may have more adverse reactions, but I haven't seen anything rigorous and scientific that proves that in any way. And I think it's possible that you will have side effects from your second dose if you did with the first dose. Hopefully they won't be worse. And I would recommend that if and when you develop any symptoms, you hydrate yourself well, take some pain reliever like Motrin or acetaminophen and rest. And hopefully it won't be too bad.
And for those listening who have not yet been vaccinated and are afraid of an experience like Erica's, how long should one expect to have side effects from a vaccine if one does?
Yeah, our experience with this has been pretty repetitive in that people seem to have side effects mostly for one day following the vaccine. Some people can really say it's 24 hours exactly. Some people say the day after is the worst. And most people are back to normal 2 to 3 days later at the most.
All right, let's try to get one more question to Nancy in Chelmsford. Nancy, go ahead.
Hi, yes, our son-in-law, Andy, had the Johnson & Johnson vaccine on March 12th. He got COVID on April 14th, and he isolated for 2 weeks. They came on Mother's Day. Well, they came on Saturday, the day before May 8th. And I wanted to know, first, should Andy get revaccinated? Should he get maybe another vaccine? And also, were we at risk? My husband and I have both been vaccinated, fully vaccinated since March 10th. Were we at risk because he came on May 8th? And I also wanted to know how risky is grocery shopping?
All right, Nancy, thank you for that. And he was diagnosed, it sounds like, Dr. Gill, in mid-April. So we have a short amount of time, so quick answers for those, Dr. Gill. You're the last call here.
I'll go fast. So unfortunate that your son-in-law got sick after being vaccinated. Sounds like he had time to mount a full immune response, and yet he is one of the unlucky ones who is still able to get sick. So when I said earlier that, you know, the protection is very good, but it's not 100%, this is an example of that. But in terms of his immune system now, he's been exposed to the vaccine as well as to the virus itself. One would anticipate that unless he has some sort of immunodeficient state, which I doubt, that his immune system is now fully resistant to COVID-19. The question about, you know, how concerned should you be in a grocery store is, now that you have received your vaccines, the risk of you having severe or fatal COVID-19 is close to 0%. Nonetheless, I think it's still reasonable to wear a mask whenever you're indoors in a crowded place.
Okay, thank you so much for that. And listen, callers, we've left a couple of you there. I'm sorry, but as you know, we will continue to do these Ask the Doctor segments, so keep listening for when they come. Dr. Christopher Gill, an infectious disease clinician and researcher at Boston University, Dr. Helen Boucher, Chief of Infectious Diseases at Tufts Medical Center, thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Look carefully while you're walking in, say, South Boston, and you might see a painting. More specifically, on-plane air paintings of landscapes left in the places that inspired them. They include scenes from Carson Beach, The Fens, and World's End in Hingham. And they are the work of Jake Garcia, the artist behind the Twitter handle Jakescapes. Garcia leaves them for the first person to get their hands on them, free of charge. The whole idea is to make people smile. And it's gotten so much attention that NBC Nightly News' Lester Holt took notice and talked to Jake about it.
These are bringing joy to people, but you don't often see the final connection, do you?
When I look at art, I feel like a lot of joy out of it. So my main goal, like, which I think is really nice, that you can kind of make somebody's day without saying a word.
Jake Garcia joins us now to tell us more about this undertaking. Welcome to Radio Boston, Jake.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I don't have one of your paintings, nor have I seen one, but you brought a smile to my face for doing this. This is kind of cool, Jake.
Yeah, it's very strange how it took off. It definitely makes my day to see other people kind of improve their day by just finding a piece of art, you know?
So let's begin at the beginning. I understand you're a nursing student. How did you start painting at all?
I painted in high school a little bit. I'm 34 now, so that was quite a long time ago. My brother had sent me some art stuff about 6 months ago. He sent me some pencils and paper, and I was drawing. I was like, I really miss this. And then I just got some paints, and I decided to start painting. I just figured I'd like to try it again and started YouTubing some tutorials and found out I really enjoyed it. So I kept up with it.
And how did you pick your locations?
I walk around the beach a lot and I walk around the city a lot. And I kind of just whatever I see that I kind of like. It's hard to make a good composition sometimes, but, whatever inspires me, I guess, you know.
So I am picturing you, you're painting. Okay, well, let me backtrack. Where were you the first time? What did you paint the first time you left a painting for someone?
So the first time I painted, I was down at Carson Beach near the dock there, and I painted it. And then I was walking back, and I walked quite a ways, and the wet paintings are kind of, it's just not fun to carry them. So I sat on a bench and I just thought I should just leave this here. I wonder if anybody would take it, you know. I thought it'd be funny if I walked into somebody's house and then I saw my painting there and I was like, hey, where'd you get that, you know?
So do you know, did someone take it?
So that's never been claimed. The first two, I don't know what happened. There's another one, there's a third one I don't know what happened to either. So I'm not sure where that went.
Does that make you feel vulnerable as an artist to put your art out there and have some of these pieces just kind of go off into the ether and you don't know?
You can take art and you can bring it home and you can put it in a box forever, or you can share it with people. The idea that somebody's going to maybe find joy out of that is totally worth it for me. Like, it's not worth it for me to just stash it in a box. You know what I mean? Like, it's just not, that doesn't bring me any joy. And the process is what I like going out there and trying to figure out these problems. How am I going to do this? That's where I get all the joy. So the product is nice, but, you know, you can only look at a painting for so long that you have that's your own, you know? And if I do a bunch of them, it's, you know.
So what are the problems that you have to solve? Let's talk about that process a little bit.
So when you look at a scene, it's not really what it looks like. Like, you think like, oh, that must be blue. And then you find out it's not really blue. Like, your eyes play a lot of tricks on you. So you have to kind of figure out like what's going on as far as the atmospheric perspective. So how far away something is, you know, the yellow and the red is going to disappear out of that. And you're going to be left with only blue. So you got to figure out like, that's far away, that's going to be a little lighter, you know? So you kind of have to work out some problems using a little bit of color theory. If you have any knowledge on it, I have very little. And, you know, where to place things. You don't always have to put everything you see in the picture. I painted a picture today at the Fens and there was a big tractor there and I didn't put the tractor in. And I didn't, you know, it's you can leave something out if you want, you know, so you kind of got to figure out what you want to put in and then kind of figure out how's this going to go together and what colors are there. So there's a lot that goes on in it, you know, and that kind of puzzle is that process is really fun for me.
So I got to know, did you leave that painting at the Fens? Is it sitting out there right now? Somebody wants to go get it, or did you keep that one?
No, so I left it, but somebody got it really fast. So I put them up on my, I put them out, and then I put them on my social media, and people have been getting them like very quickly, you know, since it was on the news. So now I think some people follow, and then so people have been getting it kind of quickly, you know. So I usually have them, if they tag me, I put them on my Instagram, you know, and like say like, oh, I painted a picture for, you know, whoever it is, Ralph, whoever it is, you know, and that's been enjoyable for me.
Okay, so let's talk about Ralph for a second. Ralph Menzioni picked up one of your paintings, and he talked about it with NBC Nightly News. Here's what he told them.
When I end up leaving Boston area, it's something that I can always take with me. So I think it's just cool. It kind of brightens someone's day really quick, and it's a unique little find.
Does that feel good to hear?
Yeah, it does. And I saw Ralph's pic, like I saw her just smiling with a painting. Like that's like the best. You know, I was telling somebody, one of my really good friends today, like I was like, the best thing of the best part of this whole thing is when somebody is like, I found this painting, and then they tell you on social media, I usually see it, and they're like so happy. Like that's like wild, you know, like we live in a world where everything is so negative. A lot of things are really negative. So just to see that, just something good happening is really, for me, like, that's a big deal, you know, because that's the kind of person I want to, that's what I want to be. Like, I don't want to be a person who's part of the problem, you know. I want to be like starting to be part of a solution to, you know, a better world, even if it is really small in the scheme of things.
So that strikes me because you are a nursing student. It sounds like helping is just kind of at your core.
Yeah, I've always been really interested in nursing. It took me a while to go to school. You know, I found that when you help somebody in a selfish way, you tend to not think about yourself as much. So in turn, you're a little bit happier. So you're not caught up in your head, and you're not caught up in all this negative stuff going on, because it's really hard to think about yourself when you're helping somebody else. So all this stuff does have a selfish element to it, you know? I do like to help people, and I do like to see people grow and improve. And I like to help that along.
How many Ralphs are out there? How many people have picked up paintings of yours at this point?
Five, I believe. I'd have to fact check that. Five that I know of. There was a recent one at World's End that wasn't picked up that I loved. I loved that picture. But
how
I don't know
do you
where
know
it
wasn't picked up?
Well, maybe it was picked up by somebody that doesn't have social media, which is cool too. You know, I guess it wasn't tagged. So let's put it that way.
There we go. And how many of these do you want to do? I mean, this is a thing now. How long do you think you'll keep doing it?
If I enjoy it and it brings happiness to myself and others, I'll continue to do it. You know, if I stop enjoying it, or, you know, it's not in something I want to do, I'll stop. I do this because I really like it. Like, I'm not doing this to, like, you know, whatever. Like, I'm not doing this for, like, any type of popularity or anything like that. Like, I'm painting because I really like it. And I didn't set out to, like, be, like, this really good person and like help a lot of people. I just thought maybe somebody would like it if they found a piece of art, you know, like that was it. Like, it wasn't like this, I didn't think it was going to catch on, you know. So it depends on how long this goes for, how long I'm interested in it.
That is Jake Garcia, the artist behind Jakescapes. Jake, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you can keep up with Jake's paintings and where to find them via Twitter at Jakescapes. That's our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman, with help from Stephen Gelman and Hafsa Qureshi. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tisiana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.